hope you can stay until the discussion part. If you have questions, that will be the time to ask.
Thanks again. Thanks for staying this late. I added the word agrochemicals to the title for one reason, because when we worked with this technology, we initiated the studies, we were not really, trying to work with nucleic acids at that time. We were trying to work with the improving the efficiency of penetrations of other agrochemicals. For example, we're trying antibiotics in the citrus industry. So what I'm going to do today, I'm just going down chronologically how we developed the technique, and then at the end I'm going to give some samples of the nucleic acid RNAi. I have to say that the laser person here is Luis Ponce, and the molecular biology here is Nabil Kalini. Okay. So in agriculture, foliar applications are preferred for obvious reasons, because you can cover a swath of tract a lot easier than if you treat every plant individually. But there is a problem. It's called the cuticle. And oops. Well, I just don't have lost the pointer. But you can see the cuticle out there, kind of the thick layer, a little exaggerated in this sample. But the cuticle, as you know, it evolved as a means to prevent desiccation, but at the same time also prevents chemicals to move into the plant. The cuticle is composed as going from the epidermal cells into the outside by a you have the cell wall in combination with some cutin. Towards the outside, you have cutin, wax, and pectin, and then at the outside, you have cutin and wax, and the uppermost layer is a wax, which makes the plant very hydrophobic. As you can see on the right side, you're familiar with that. So when you spray something that is aqueous into a plant, most likely it's not going to go into the plant. It's very ineffective. These are other examples of very thick cuticles, and again, these are just to the end, to the one of the extremes. They're very thick. These are stained with Sudan red, I'm sure. But it tells you that the barrier, the size, the intensity of the barrier that you have to overcome to put something into the plant to make it work. Penetration into the leaves, and this is parts of the plant that are still green, are possible through the stomates, cracks in the cuticle, and also through the polysaccharide matrix. But they're all very ineffective. The stomates are not very reliable because a lot of times during the day they're closed, and we talked about this. Under stress, under a lot of circumstances, these stomates are closed and not allowing any kind of solutes to move in. And there's also a shape effect here. The fact that the stomates are sort of like oval also accentuates the surface tension, which prevents liquids to move in. The cracks in the cuticle, they're not very frequently. They're few and far in between, not very effective. And the polysaccharide matrix, which is the cutin and waxes, is very tight. And the pores in the polysaccharide matrix are very tiny. They're 1 to 2 nanometers. So the molecules that can go through, even if they overcome all the charges, they cannot be larger than 2 nanometers. And to give you an example, an example here so you can have a perspective, a molecule of sucrose is about 700 nanometers. I'm sorry, angstroms. So a 2 molecules of sucrose, a trisaccharide, for example, raffinose, will have a hard time going through there. So you're talking about the molecular level now. So it's not very easy to get through, to penetrate that cuticle. So how can we overcome that? Well, let's see if we can make some perforations to the cuticle. So in the laboratory, I had this laser machine on the left side, and I was using it for something else, and we just decided to let's try it, see whether we can create some perforations on the cuticle, and we accelerate the uptake of all those chemicals. In the middle picture, I'm not so sure it's so clear to you guys, we created a pattern. It's a dot matrix pattern, and so it's just full of, it's composed of a lot of dots. And on the right side, is the same leaf or another leaf being viewed under the fluorescent microscope. Somehow, when the laser hits the cuticle, it fluoresces. So it has a certain degree of autofluorescence. And I'm saying this because this is going to become a part of it's going to be interfering later on in the study. So this is what you would see under the microscope. You'll see those dots. These are perforations. This is a little video here of a perforation. So now you can see in more detail that not only you break the cuticle, you also break the epidermis. And you can see the cells at the background, which are also damaged by the laser. That's something we have to take into account. Let me do it again. That's towards the outside. You see the cuticle kind of bursting to the outside, but there is damage to the epidermis and sometimes to the palisade tissue. Oops, let me go to the next. These are other SEM pictures on the left. Again, the same is obvious. You have the cuticle being kind of burst to the outside, and then you have some damage done to the underlying cells. But at least you open a gap. At least you're opening the interior, the apoplasm, into any kind of substance you're going to apply. And on the right side, you have a cryosection, which is almost like a live section. It's cryo, it's dead, but it's done fresh. And you can tell very clearly the cuticle being burst and the epidermal layers also being destroyed. A couple of weeks later, this is an SEM images, there is some kind of healing. And there is, if you wait a month or so, there is a lot of healing underneath these perforations. These few weeks later, and you can see there's kind of a ring around the perforations, and that indicates that there's some kind of healing. So to study the penetration of some kind of substances, we began with something that is more natural. We decided to use something that as close to natural as possible. So we use an analog of glucose, which is a natural molecule, so you know that. We use MBDG, which is a fluorescent version of deoxyglucose. And deoxyglucose is a molecule that is indistinguishable to glucose to plant cells. Plant cells will take deoxyglucose, but will not utilize it. They'll take it, they transport it as if it was glucose, but they will not utilize it. So we took fluorescent deoxyglucose, and we applied here on the right side. It's just right after, 30 minutes after we applied deoxyglucose into the laser area, as opposed or contrary to the lower end, the lower panel, which is the control. And you can see that there is a shinier background, and the right panels you see what you would see in a closer look on the fluorescent microscope. The right D, pretty obvious that the red is the red fluorescence from the chloroplast or chlorophyll. And in the top side, in the top panel, you see that everything is green. So that the deoxyglucose has moved around and has created kind of a blanket around the epidermal cells. After 4 hours, we take a leaf that has been perforated and treated with MBDG. And you look at under the underside, and on the right side of the top left panel, you see the dots where the deoxyglucose is applied, and then you'll see the veins. As they have been taken, the MBDG has been taken, absorbed by the phloem cells, and transported down the veins to the mid vein. As you can see, then the lower left panel is a close up of the middle vein, and the transport is fairly clear against a background of chlorophyll. On the right side, you have either a close up, or not a close up, but a closer view of the petiole. So at 4 hours later, the sugars have been taken up and transported down the petiole. And those are just two shots. This is some hours later, and the right side is what we saw already, is the mid vein and the leaf. And the right side is a cross section of the petiole and a close look. And you can see the phloem very delineated as they shine for containing MBDG. And that gives you the sense that assures you that it's being taken up and moved by the phloem cells. On the bottom panels is the bark underneath the leaf. And this is a citrus tree, by the way. So we took the bark that's underneath the leaf, and we look at a cross-section of it. On the left side, panel C, is the one that has been treated with deoxyglucose. And on the right side is the control one. And you can see there's a slight difference in the green fluorescence. The idea at that time was to look at the mobilization of a lot of the compounds, and we were more interested in antibiotics because the citrus industry is being devastated by a bacterial disease. So our interest was more into antibiotics, and those two are in green, penicillin and vancomycin. But the whole idea was here to test a lot of compounds that we can find that had fluorescence, and here we need a marker for those compounds. So to look at the movement, we needed something that has fluorescent attached to it. So we did a whole bunch of compounds, and they are listed down by molecular weight. This is the second column. The concentration we use, and then the excitation emission is not really critical. And then plus or minus means at the end whether they were mobilized or not, because not every compound is mobilized. If you look down, and I can just kind of pass on this list later on, you see that it's not related to molecular weight in this case because it's also a charge effect. Some molecules are small enough, but they are charged, and they will not be transported. So on the right side, you have a whole list of the pluses are the ones that will be transported. And some of those are natural compounds like ATP, for example. Penicillin was transported, but not vancomycin. So you never know whether something is going to be transported or not. And, of course, the fluorophore also has some effect on this. We go all the way down into the PAM-AM dendrimers, lysine tRNA, and lysine is not a large molecule, but it's not transported. And then, of course, we have quantum dots, and I'm going to go to that in a minute. Those are not transported. So once we realize that not every molecule is transported, or not every molecule moves through the cell walls and picked up by the phloem cells, we decided to do a size exclusion. And to do that, we purchase or synthesize molecules of different sizes. So we went on to the control here is NBDG, which is now, you saw already, fluorescent deoxyglucose. That'll be the control. And we decided to then test different particles, starting with the smallest one. This is another control here, is fluorescent trihalose. And trihalose is a disaccharide such as glucose. And plants transport glucose. They have trihalose. So it should be expected that they take up and transport trihalose. And they did. On the left, on the upper panel, is the leaf after trihalo was applied. On the right panel is water. There's nothing. There's a little fluorescent from the autofluorescence. The petiole on the bottom left is trihalose later on. You can see it's transported by the phloem. And then the right side is a cross-section of the just plain water, the petiole. The first nanoparticle was 1.4 nanometer nanogold particles. And we saw that there was no problem at all when we applied nanoparticles of that size. They're applied on the upper panel, A. You can see that the nanoparticles move down down to the blade and to the vascular bundle. B is water, and then C is the petiole. So nanoparticles were transported into the phloem cells and being mobilized, and they were mobilized down the petiole, as you can see in C. And D is a close-up. And I think there's no question about that. That is the phloem, shiny as they could be. So nanoparticles of 1.4 nanometers are easily taken up by the cells, by the plant, transported, and so on and so on. We go on to 3.6 and 4.5 nanoparticles. We saw again that there was uptake and transport at that size, 3.6. Those are our copper nanoparticles and PAM-AM dendrimers, 4.5, also are picked up and transported. Then we go up to 5.4 and 6.7 nanometers, and that's where we stop. At 5.4, we observed transport, but a day later. Excuse me. Took that long for those particles to either mobilize or move through the cell walls and be picked up by the phloem and then transported. But it took overnight for us to see anything at the petiole. At 6.7, we never saw anything. So that is the cutoff. Somewhere between 5.4 and 6.7 is the size exclusion. Anything larger than that, you're not going to be able to use, at least in citrus. These are other plants. Other species have a different kind of molecular composition. The structure of the cell wall is a little different. So you may have some variations on this. But in case of citrus, I think anything beyond, you don't want to get even to 5, because 5 is a little tough to get in. So you want to use something smaller than that, smaller than 5, if you're going to apply any kind of molecule to remedy anything into the plant. And these are nanodots. These are crystals of 10 nanometers and 15 nanometers. And again, they get into the perforation, but they just don't move. They stay there. And they're too large for that matter. So the take-home message here is that phloem, the size exclusion is about 5.5 to 6, but if you really want to use something, you want to make it move and be effective in a plan, you probably want to stay a little lower than 5. And also that the, and more interesting is that phloem cells take nanoparticles. They're able to pick up nanoparticles and move, despite the fact that these are not natural compounds. And that's, I was very surprised, because we also put later on with the other studies, and we put plastic nanoparticles, polystyrene nanoparticles, and they're also taken up by the phloem cells. So cells, phloem cells seem to not have a lot of, even though they seem to be very efficient in discriminating organic molecules, when it comes to nanoparticles, they seem to take them, polystyrene, nanocrystals, and you name it. So I don't know the mechanism by they take this, but they are capable of taking large molecules. So from here we jump to RNA, the technology. A colleague of mine is a molecular biologist. He saw that I was working on this technology. He said, well, why don't we use it for RNAi? Because so far the mechanisms to use RNAi in plants are very obsolete. They're not very efficient. You put the little plants in plastic bags and just let the roots absorb it. And it takes a long time and, you know, so on and so on. So there's not a real effective mechanism to introduce RNAi into plants. So what he did, and these are just methods that are being used at that time or still today, root drench, that's not very efficient. Foliar spray, everything stays on the surface. And trunk injection, in case that, if you were to use that in the field, you're going to have to spend a lot of time. So he decided to just go on to an experiment using, or to prove a concept. He decided to use an RNA construct of cyanide labeled PDS, which is phytoenediesterase, which is an enzyme in the carotenoid biosynthetic pathway. So the idea is to block the expression of this enzyme. And if you do that, the plant will develop some albino spots. So when you block the production of this enzyme, or you would eventually block the production of chlorophyll. And you can evidence that by white spots. This was compared to transgenic plants with the same gene, with the same construct, and those were developed by using CTV, which is a citrus restase virus. So we are comparing transgenic plants to this new system, this mechanism, which is applying the RNAi into the leaf or onto the leaf. This is another little video. By that time, by the way, I should say that by that time we had the second generation laser machine. So this machine was a little more adaptable to the laboratory conditions, and it covered a little more surface than the first one. The first one was just kind of a dot matrix. This one, okay, here we are. This one, you could modify how you want to have your laser areas, either lines or dots or curves or letters, what have you. And if I can, here we are. These were lines. We just did lines for convenience. Well, somehow this turned around. It was soup. I hope you can see that. It was not stretched like that. It was a little more condensed. But I don't know where you can see that, on the kind of the smoke burning out of the other corner. Oh, that's the lines. It was a little more clear. I don't know why it was stretched and turned around, for that matter. But there you are. The machine, the laser gun goes up and down, and just kind of produces these lines rather than dots. In that way, they usually have a lot more surface area. That's once again, I think you can see it, sort of. You may not be able to see you guys here, but... And he goes out randomly, kind of drawing lines, you know, just going this side and that side, and you can modify that as you will. Okay, so this is the way it looked afterwards. This is the another plant. I'm not so sure it's the same one. That's the way it looked. We had all those lines, all these perforations, and now it's not a little dot. It's just a whole line. And on the right side is under fluorescence microscopy and tells you that it's fairly a good size. You have a lot of surface area available for penetration of substances. So here we are. So this is the data. On the left panel, the left panels are water controls. So plants were taken. They're treated with water control. The other one with MBDG, just to make sure that the system works. That's another control. And the third panel on the right is the RNAi against the phytoenediesterase. So water, as expected, there's nothing on the right panel, nothing on the patio, and the leaf, of course, there's nothing fluorescing. With the fluorescent deoxyglucose middle panels, it's the lines you can see shining. The phloem fluoresces at the patio because it carries the MBDG. And then the bottom one is the blade, and of course, it has a lot of fluorescence. And on the right side, the right panel, it is the RNAi fluorescent. Then it was picked up by the phloem cells and moved, because you can see now the petiole, and then the blade you can see at the bottom end, which is also very fluorescent. So the cell picked up the double-stranded RNA and mobilized it as well. So from here we can, let me just see, we had the data. Oh, there they are. There it is. So that's what I said. We learned that the plant can take the double-strand RNA can move through the cell wall, is picked up by the cell, and then mobilized. And here's the data. On panel A is the one on the left is the control, treated with water. The one in the middle is the cells, the tree has been transformed with CTV, but that is 6 months later. So you have to make a point here. Remember that the CTV was a transformed plant. It took 6 months for the plant to develop, or not 6 months, but took that long to develop very clear white islands. And on the right side, the three, is the double-stranded RNA. 3 days afterwards, only 3 days. The panel B is the stem. And, of course, the lower panels are a close-up of the leaves. And as you can see, it's a lot faster, 3 days, delivering RNA through laser perforation is a lot faster. The gene expression also was compared, and the left side is the control. The middle side is the CTV, the transformed plant, and the gene expression in the control plant, or CTV, is a lot lower than the one using RNA, but it's not as fast. So another step was then to see now that we know that it works in the plants, how can we adapt this into another system, let's say against invading pests? So what Nabil did was he did an RNAi against a psyllid. Psyllid is an insect, feeds on phloem on citrus trees. So what he did, though, he reported genes. He put RNA against muscle, development of muscle, and wings. So we treated the plant. He applied the RNAi into the plant. He waited about 3 weeks or so, let the plant do its own stuff with the RNA. I'm not a molecular biologist, so that's what I'm using that such a scientific terms. And then he put psyllids, female psyllids, in that bag on the top and let the psyllids lay eggs. So we'll trace the development of those nymphs. So after some time, he comes back and looked at the nymphs, how they developed after they were treated with all this anti-muscle, anti-wing, and RNA. So here we are. On the left side, that would be a control young adult psyllid. And on the right side, it is a psyllid developed from a tree that was treated with the RNAi. And you can see that it's not really very recognizable as a psyllid. It has curled wings, incomplete molting, stunt body, and stretch wing. You cannot see whether it's a head or the tail in some of those psyllids. And these are four more examples. On the top left is a control, and the ones on the right and bottom panels are others from the treated trees. So in essence, it proves that treating the trees with double-stranded RNA using the laser technology is quite fast and quite effective. And this is the control. Survival is less than 40% in those treated with the double-strand RNA. Okay, so now about the technology itself, laser. There's nothing yet that can take this technology into the field, even though there's a company right now working on it, and they say that within the next several months, they're going to be starting to test three prototypes in the field, and that is to go into the field and try to, say, laser, and the idea is that the same machine lasers and sprays the trees at the same time. But at the same time, this gentleman here, Luis Ponce, came to the laboratory and he developed something even better because he developed a very manual machine. Is that what you have in front of you? And the advantages of this is that you can go, you can stand at any distance from the plant and shoot it with the laser, and you create the same punctures as if you were with the other machine, which is actually even worse because the other one you have to be at a certain distance. This one you can do any distance from the plant. Secondly, the other machines probably cost $500,000. These will cost about $5,000. So this new technology is also a lot better because it doesn't perforate the epidermal cells. It only breaks the cuticle. So this guy, what he did, he used a wavelength that is unique to the cuticle, to the waxy layer on top. So when he shoots the laser onto the leaf, he only breaks the cuticle. He doesn't touch, he doesn't disturb the epidermal cells underneath that. And so in that case, you don't create another passageway for perhaps other diseases. Also, the circle, the radius that he treats, the circle here, the diameter of the one of those dots, is about half a centimeter as opposed to 250 micrometers, which is the other system. So this is a step up from the initial. And that always happens. You know, you start with something, and then, of course, you develop the new technology. So this covers a lot more area. It's a lot faster. It's a lot cheaper. And it doesn't create as much damage into the plant. This is just the same thing, a little close up. On the left in the middle, but the middle one is just when it's stained. The cuticle is stained with Sudan red. And you can see that there's some perforations on the cuticle, but the green of the epidermal cells you can see clearly on the background. And on the right side is just one treated with MBDG. This, another sample, we hit the leaf on the left, we hit four times. We applied the oxyglucose. A few hours later, we looked at it, and you can see the veins are just completely covered. I mean, they have taken a lot of the oxyglucose and they're transporting it down the phloem. Excuse me, on the right side you have a cross-section of the petiole showing you the intensity of transport for only one leaf. And I just stop there. If you have any questions, I just have to acknowledge the funding agencies, CRDF and the USDA. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dr. Edgar.